when Pastor Joel asked your favorite book of the Bible is, I was thinking to myself, you know, I can relate to the preachers that I've heard say this before, who have stated that their favorite book of the Bible is whatever they are preaching through that at that time. I know that may sound like a cop-out, but I don't know if Joel or Pastor Slutz, if this has been true for you, but I know it's been true for me whenever I was preaching through Colossians a year or so ago and went through 1 John in depth with the teens a couple years ago. And even as I was going through our Sunday school series of doing an overview on each book of the Bible, I just kept walking away with, wow, this book is so amazing. And I find myself thinking that often when I read the Pentateuch books, which is where we'll be tonight, looking again at Exodus as we continue talking about our topic, why Israel, why the church. And kind of like you, Brother Dale, talking about Leviticus and just looking at all the different books of the Pentateuch, it is just so cool to see what God was doing in the life of Israel as a nation and how that correlates and parallels to what he does with us and how we have the new covenant so much better than the old covenant. So looking forward to coming back to this topic tonight after being away from it for several months now. So because it's been a while, I'd like to just do a little review as far as where we've been. It's been about a year since we first started this sermon series. So jumping back into where we are, reviewing the very first message that we had, we talked about what is the message of the Bible. And we looked at the message of the Bible is about how it's God's glorifying mission to restore mankind to fellowship with himself in his kingdom through his son, Jesus Christ. And through that, bringing glory to himself. A simplified version of that is it's God's rescue plan for mankind. We sinned. We messed up. Adam and Eve failed in the garden. But God is seeking to restore us and reestablish his rule on earth through his son, Jesus Christ, which Satan and mankind has sought to throw off. And the key plot line or three key concepts that appear right even from the get-go that kind of govern the rest of the Old Testament and really the Bible are those three key words is creation, fall, redemption. Now, we've gone through the whole story of the Bible, and we traced God's redemptive plan for his people, and we noted the theme, we've been noting the theme of God's people dwelling with him in his special place, his special land, and how God continually pursues his people. So again, going back at creation, we looked how God set up an earthly kingdom and created mankind. And he created mankind for a few reasons. One was to glorify him. Two, for man to be able to enjoy an obedient relationship with him. And then three, to exercise domain or dominion and rule over God's earthly kingdom. You see this in Genesis 1, 26 and 27. God says, let them have dominion. And that word domain is a rulership term, a kingdom-like term. So we essentially could view Adam and Eve as God's vice regents ruling over God's land, over this earth on God's behalf. But as we know, at the fall, mankind rebels against God's rules, God's laws, and forfeits the privilege of living in God's land, in God's presence. So now life is going to be hard. And thankfully, they were not without hope. And that's where the redemption comes in. Redemption is promised right after the fall, and God promises that the seed of the woman would be the way, the key, the Messiah, to bring us back into fellowship. This Messiah would redeem mankind back to fellowship with God. So then the question is, when will this redemption come? Eve thought she had it with Cain and was very much wrong there. And we see wickedness prevail from Cain all the way to the flood, and then beyond even to Babel. And so the seed of the woman, we start following it through the line of Seth and then to Noah and Shem, all the way till we get to Abraham. And we see how God, we looked at how God chooses Abram to be the one that he's going to keep this promise about the seed of the woman. So we spent a few messages talking about why the Abrahamic covenant. And there were three key aspects of that covenant that God promised that had to do with blessing, seed, and land. And really these aspects shouldn't be too much of a surprise to us by the point even that you reach Abraham, because they're concepts that you see in Genesis even up to that point. And they're concepts that appeared throughout the rest of the Old Testament, particularly in the book of Genesis. So you've got the concept of land, and there's really a special relationship between God, mankind, and the land, which man is derived from the ground. And as a result of man's sin, man is banished from the special land that God had them in, the Garden of Eden. But now God is going to give Abraham, a descendant of Adam, a land that he will show him, and his descendants are going to possess it. And so for the rest of the Pentateuch, God is repeatedly telling them, I'm going to give you this land. And we kind of concluded from that focus on the land that unrighteous behavior results in exile from the land. Adam and Eve, their sin resulted in exile from the Garden of Eden. Even Cain, his sin, the ground was cursed even beyond the initial sin curse, and he was driven from the land. And even all the way down to the Canaanites, the Canaanites' sin is part of why they were expelled and from the land through God using the Israelites. Because of their sin, they forfeited their right to live there. And so it's obedience to God's laws is going to be crucial for Israel to be allowed to land. I don't know, are we having some problems here? Should I just stay here? Or is it booming out there a lot? Once, it's only did it once. Okay, maybe it only sounds it right here. But anyway, obviously we know that Israel failed to continually obey God's laws, and they had to go into exile. Then looking at that concept of seed, there's different aspects that refers to. Obviously the numerous physical descendants that Abraham had. It refers also to the ultimate seed, the Messiah, who would provide that way of redemption. But it also refers to his spiritual descendants, who would resemble Abraham, though not necessarily physically, but spiritually. They would resemble that same faith and trust in God. And then the concept of blessing. We looked at how God intended good fortune and upon Abraham and his descendants. And so they will enjoy a favored status from God. And those who despise them, look down on them, lightly esteem them, are going to have divine misfortune come upon them. And this is really what happened in the Garden of Eden. Initially, mankind had the blessings of God, the good favor of God. But because of sin, their choice, there was the divine curse, the sin curse. Then in the last couple messages, we've looked at why the Exodus. Looking at what was the purpose of the Exodus at that time. What was God doing? What was he trying to accomplish? And we looked at how the acts of God in the Exodus event demonstrate his primary desire for making his name known among all the nations through his mighty works. And there were two key points that we looked at there. How God was delivering his people for the sake of his relationship to Israel. And that had several different sub-points we won't talk about for the sake of time. But as you remember, maybe just looking at those would jog your memory. But also, he was also delivering his people to demonstrate the glory of God. He wanted people to know him. He wanted Israel to know him. He wanted to know the Egyptians and Pharaoh and all the nations to know him. And we looked at several different verses there that just demonstrate how prevalent this concept is, that God wants Israel and all the nations to know that he alone is God and he is powerful. And then we looked at the last time that we looked at this topic, of why Israel, why the church. We looked at some echoes of the Exodus in the Old Testament, how Yahweh is a warrior God for Israel who delivers them. We saw that in the Exodus, at the Red Sea, in taking the promised land and in delivering the people from oppressors. We see this from Judges even onward. We also talked about how God acts to give, again, Israel and other nations knowledge that He alone is God. You know, we have various verses there that you can see that demonstrate that as well. And we also talked about how the Babylonian exile was kind of like a second exodus, in that God moved, interacted in His creation, moved in the heart of the Persian emperor, Cyrus, to allow Israel to come back to their land. And He didn't do this because Israel was just so pitiful, and He was just like, felt bad for them, felt sorry for them. He didn't do it because He just loved them so much. No, Ezekiel talks about in chapter 36 that it was for His own namesake that He did this, because His glory, His reputation was at stake. Essentially, Israel had made Yahweh the laughing stock of the Middle East, because they were supposed to love Him and serve Him and be a holy nation, and they hadn't done that. And so because of that, God had to justly judge them, send them into captivity, like He said He would do if they didn't obey Him. And all the other nations are sitting around saying, "Huh, that Yahweh, that God, the God of the Israelites, He couldn't even protect them in their land. Some God He is." And so God's reputation was at stake. And so for the sake of His glory, He brought Israel back to the promised land. And so that, again, reinforces the theme that the acts of God in the Exodus event demonstrate His primary desire for making His name known among all nations through His mighty works. And this, to me, is the most important part of what, when we think about why Israel, why the church. It is through Israel that God was going to make His glory known, that God was going to reveal Himself to mankind. And it is through the church now that God is going to make Himself known to the world. It is our responsibility to then go and tell and proclaim who our God is. So now we're coming up on in the next part of the story, and we're going to look at the question, why the Mosaic Covenant? What was God trying to do in setting up the Old Covenant? What was the Mosaic Covenant supposed to accomplish? And I want to approach this from a little bit different of an angle than what we've been looking at it recently and what you might be used to hearing from. Because lately we've been hearing a great sermon series from Hebrews, from Pastor Joel, and really studying how the Old Covenant and New Covenant compare and contrast, and how Jesus is vastly superior, and the New Covenant is vastly superior because of Jesus Christ. And that's the broad picture of what's going on. And that's how we should think of it. But I want to really zoom in on what the Old Covenant, what the Mosaic Covenant meant to Israel specifically, and what was God doing with them at that time. So why was it significant, and what is God seeking to accomplish? Well, first off, we need to establish, what is a covenant? What is a covenant? The Hebrew word berith is used about 285 times in the Old Testament, and it's used in reference to marriages, alliances, covenants between two parties. But even Job makes a covenant with himself. He says, "I've made a covenant with mine eyes. Why should I then think upon a maid?" Now, there are four essential components that one author, Gordon Hugenberger, wrote and sees in covenants as it relates to Old Testament covenants and in that time period. One key purpose for covenants, or key component, is relationship. There's a relationship that is desired between the two parties. And it is with a non-relative. That's number two. Number three, it involves obligations, as in there's an inherent loyalty that is expected and obedience, and it is established with an oath. People take an oath, often accompanied by some sort of ceremony or sacrifice. You see various people in the Old Testament making covenants with one another, and setting up a monument, or, you know, pouring oil on this, even offering a sacrifice. Jacob and Laban, they make a covenant with one another. Okay, we're not going to fight each other. We're just going to go our separate ways and be at peace with each other, okay? So you see that kind of thing going on. 2,290 days ago, in approximately 4 hours, a young man watched a lovely fair maiden tread down the red carpet of an old church building. The girl of his dreams stepped forth that day. They proclaimed their love for one another, hand in hand, exchanged rings, made vows, maybe kissed, and Miss Stephanie Michelle Ware became Mrs. Jeremy Andrew Woodruff. That was a covenant of relationship. That's what marriage is. It in and of itself is a covenant. Now, in our day and age, marriage isn't often viewed as a covenant. It's not as binding in a lot of people's minds. But I want to highlight the difference between a covenant and a contract. We have contracts, that we interact with contracts more often here in our day. But they also had covenants and contracts back in the Old Testament era. So in that day and age, a contract, similar to now, there was, by giving a contract, there the key component was there was an expectation for benefits. Not so much, the primary emphasis wasn't that desire for relationship, like a marriage covenant. I married Stephanie, one of the reasons, not that there weren't benefits, but the primary reason was so that I could have a stronger, more consistent relationship with her. But with a contract, there's expected benefits. Okay, so for instance, you've got sports figures in the world like LeBron James. He has a contract, a shoe contract with Nike, and he makes a certain amount of money each year, and he promotes the brand, he wears the shoes, he'll make a commercial, and Nike pays him money. And in return, for Nike, what do they get out of the deal? Well, a bunch of people see him making commercials, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's LeBron. I want that shoe. Even though I can't pay for that $200 shoe, I want that shoe. Okay? So there's because people are seeing this popular figure, they're going to be more inclined to maybe go buy that item. So that's a contract. There's expected benefits that both people are going to get more money in that situation. We have also have contractors. We literally call them contractors to do work in various sorts of fields. So the person, if you need a contractor to come out and do some work on your house or whatever, you go, you tell him what needs to be done. Maybe you get it in writing. He gives you a quote. And then you say, okay, I agree to that price. You come do it. There's an expectation that he's going to actually do the work that you are paying him for. But there's not as much of there's not really an emphasis on relationship here. Well, the same kind of thing was going on back in the Old Testament. You've got contracts, which is more just kind of a mutual agreement. We can both benefit from this relationship. It's kind of thing-oriented, performance-oriented, because if you don't hold it up to the end of your bargain, well, then I'm not going to do my thing. The contract's just going to be broken. But with a covenant, it's beyond that. It's not that there aren't going to be benefits, but the idea is behind a covenant is that there's a desired relationship that you want with that person. And, again, not that there aren't going to be aspects of the relationship that there are performance things, but it's not solely based on performance in and of itself. There's loyalty behind it. So it's not like you go home, well, I didn't change the oil for my wife's car. She didn't want to be married to me anymore, you know. Where I've had it with her. She didn't do that job. Or, oh, no, she didn't vacuum the floor. Oh, she didn't perform. We're not married anymore. You know, I don't want this anymore. No, that's not how marriages work, or at least that's not how they should work. Because a covenant of marriage and covenants in general are more about the relationship, and they want the heart. They want loyalty that will demonstrate itself through obedience, as we'll talk about with a little bit more in a minute. So throughout years, we've got marriages being made for various reasons. You've got them made for financial gain, some for political alliances. We even see such alliances in the Old Testament. Solomon marrying the daughter of Pharaoh. That was, you could say, more of a contract marriage in a way, because there was a mutual benefit of being allies. And again, you've seen this throughout the ages. I was thinking about this, it made me laugh because I thought about this movie that is somewhat a playoff of the Cinderella story. How many of you have seen or heard of the movie called Ever After? Some of the girls. Okay, good. I'm not the only guy here with my hand up. That's okay. I have four sisters. Anyway, well, the movie Ever After is loose, somewhat based on the story of Cinderella, and the prince at one point in the movie, late in the movie, he is part of an arranged marriage with this other lady from that he doesn't even speak her language really. They're going and they're part of an arranged marriage. And the funny part out about this scene, they're like right in the wedding ceremony. She's coming down the aisle. She's just bawling. She's just crying, sobbing very loud. And it's actually quite comical. And finally, she's crying because she doesn't want to marry him. She wants to marry this other guy. And he isn't really all that jazzed about marrying her. He wants to marry Cinderella. And so they're finally out at the front, and he finally turns to her and basically says, look, let's not do this. You go have your guy, and I'll go find my girl, okay? And that's what happens. But why was she so distraught? It's because this marriage, this serious thing, there wasn't really any relationship behind it. And again, I know there's been plenty of arranged marriages over the year, and I know that people can grow in their relationship with one another through those situations. But at that moment, that girl, that lady, was completely distraught because her heart, her desire for relationship was for someone else. So now that we have the concept of relationship being behind the idea of a covenant, that's going to be very key moving forward. And as you think of the Old Covenant or the covenants in the Old Testament, there's two key kinds. There's the unconditional kinds of covenants that we come across. God's covenant with Noah that he would never flood the entire earth again. The Abrahamic covenant was unconditional. The Davidic covenant was unconditional. At least there were parts of it that were conditional as they related directly to David's immediate descendants. And then the Mosaic covenant is a conditional covenant. In other words, there's something that in order for all the benefits to be fully enjoyed for this Mosaic covenant, Israel is going to have to do something. It's going to have to meet the requirements. So why the Mosaic covenant? You think about, we have the Abrahamic covenant. Israel's the descendants of Abraham. And that already includes the promise of blessing and seed and land. And here they are as a great nation. And they're on their way to going to get a land, hopefully. Why do we need another? Well, it is through the Old Covenant that we see God's desire to do three things. And we'll only look at one of them tonight. Number one, we see God's desire to formally enter a relationship with his people as a nation. Number two, we see God's desire to dwell with his people. And number three, to create a holy people or a holy nation for himself. And as a holy people, they could then dwell with them. Now, I'm going to repeat those, but I want you to listen to them with the frame of mind of the Garden of Eden, what Adam and Eve once had, what mankind once had. Through the Old Covenant, through the Mosaic Covenant, we see God's desire to formally enter into a relationship with his people as a nation, as he once had. He once had a close, intimate relationship with mankind in the Garden of Eden. We see God's desire to dwell with his people as he once did in the Garden of Eden. And then we see God's desire to create a holy people for himself as mankind once was, again, in the Garden of Eden. Well, how is each one accomplished? Again, these last two we'll go over next time. But to create a holy people, a holy nation for himself, they're going to need to be sanctified. They must live holy, clean lives. Atonement must be made for their sins, and they must have a holy representative to mediate on their behalf. To dwell with his people, Israel must build for God a holy dwelling place. That's the tabernacle. And then today, what we'll look at the rest for the last few minutes that we're together is God initiates the Mosaic covenant with Israel in order to enter into that formal relationship with his people as a nation. I think it's really neat and really special that God desires to have a relationship with his people, with mankind, with each one of you, with me. God desires that relationship, even though he doesn't need it. He's not lonely. It wasn't to meet something that he was lacking. It was out of the goodness of his heart that he wanted to give us that opportunity to enjoy a relationship with him. And so this is God's way of getting back some semblance of what was lost in the garden. He is now initiating a covenant with Abraham's seed that has grown into a nation. He is initiating this covenant to formalize that relationship with him. Not just as the promised seed of Abraham, but as an official nation, his special chosen people. If you're in Exodus, we're going to be looking at it in chapter 19, at a few verses here, looking at verses 4 through 6. Now, the concept of Israel being his special chosen people and God desiring a relationship with him has already been hinted at even before Mount Sinai, which is where we find ourselves in chapter 19. It was hinted at in Exodus 6:7, and later Moses reminds them of God's gracious choice of them in Deuteronomy 7, verse 6. But in chapter 19, verses 4 through 6, we see God saying to Moses, "Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings, and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar people unto me. A peculiar treasure, excuse me, unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel." So here, God is initiating this covenant just after delivering them out of slavery. So Israel is now ready to make a covenant with the God of their fathers that really, beforehand, they had not personally known him. Yes, they had heard the stories of the patriarchs, and they had known the God of their fathers. But they are also, as later passages, even what we read this morning in our call to worship, they were also intermingling, at least some of them, with idolatry, the idols of the Egyptians. So they hadn't heard from God in some 400 years since Jacob. God told Jacob, yes, it's okay to go down to Egypt. I'll bring you back out at a later time. They hadn't heard from God in a long time. The patriarchs had known God and he had communicated with them. But Israel as a nation did not. And so the Exodus really, in a way, reintroduced them or reminded Israel who Yahweh is. And here at Mount Sinai, through the giving of the covenant, God is going to further reveal himself to them, who he is. So the mighty acts of God, this mighty God who had delivered them, is wanting to be their God and have this close relationship with them. So he initiates this covenant. And if you notice, the basis for this covenant is based on who God is, his character, and what he has done for them. Verse 4 again, "Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians." And then verse 5, he goes on and says, "If you will obey my voice." If you jump over to chapter 20, verse 2, it says, "I am the Lord thy God, which hath brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." So basically God is saying, I'm the one that just delivered you out of slavery. And now I want to have a relationship with you. I am God Almighty. I am a powerful God. And so all the laws that come from the old covenant, they're then going to govern the relationship with God and provide them with a way to maintain that relationship through obedience. Because remember, they were saved to serve him. In Exodus 9, verse 1, Moses says to Pharaoh, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go that they may serve me." So God's intent on delivering the Israelites was so that they would serve him. So I want to just quickly go through the story of the giving of the law. We won't read all the verses that we have here, but at the beginning of chapter 19, we see that after 3 months after the Exodus, they arrive at Mount Sinai. That's in verse 1. Verses 4 through 6, we have the initial offer of a covenant relationship with Israel. Israel is invited to respond. And it's, again, based on what God did for them. It's conditional upon their obedience, which is already mentioned in chapter 15, verse 26. But it's not just obedience, lest we think it's kind of like that contract aspect where you hold your brew, you're in the bar, and I'll hold up mine. It's not just strictly obedience. It's also, there's a heart of love that is needed. At the heart of the covenant's requirements is love and loyalty, which will demonstrate itself in obedience. If you have gone to chapter 20, in verse 6, God says, showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Loving God and keeping his commandments are, we can't separate those. What did Jesus even say in the New Testament? If ye love me, keep my commandments. That's a key way to demonstrate that we love God. You can't say that I don't love God, or we can't say that I love God, but I don't do anything that he says. Then you're like, well, do you really love God? But it is possible to just do externally things on the outside, God, and obey a lot of the God's laws, but not have a heart of love. This is what the Old Testament prophets constantly had to rebuke the Israelites for. Why? Because in a lot of ways, externally speaking, they were doing what was right. In addition to their idolatry, we'll just set that aside for a second. In addition to their idolatry, they were offering sacrifices. They often would offer sacrifices in Yahweh's name and do this and that. But they were ignoring some of the other things, parts of the law. They were not caring for the poor. They were allowing corruption in the justice system, favoritism, bribes, etc. And that showed that they wanted to do their lip service to God and kind of do what they needed to do to appease God on the religious front, but then just go and live however they want. That demonstrated even though they were obeying God, they didn't actually love God. So this, at the heart of the covenant's requirements, is love and loyalty. This covenant is conditional upon their obedience. And the result is that they would be a peculiar treasure, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. And these verses really highlight the special relationship between God and Israel and the status, the favored status that they're going to enjoy as particularly in regards as both a royal priesthood status. One author said that everything points to this being a restoration of the status that humanity lost through Adam and Eve's betrayal of God in the Garden of Eden. As a kingdom of priests, Israel will soon be involved in the construction of a dwelling place for God. So here we are. God gives this initial offer of a covenant. He hasn't told them specifics yet. This is just an initial offer. If you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me and a holy nation and a kingdom of priests. So then, verses 7 and 8, Moses goes back down, tells the people what God said, and the people agree. They give their initial agreement. This is verbal confirmation number one from the people. All that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So what follows then? Well, then in verses 10 through 15, we see the consecration and the preparation for Israel to meet with the Lord. They're supposed to wash themselves. They're supposed to wash their clothes and get ready to meet God. And beginning in verses 16 through the end of the chapter, really, we see God visits the people and speaks to them. Verse 16, it says, "And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled." And verse 18 says, "And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in a fire. And the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. And when the voice of the Lord, when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake, and God answered him via a voice." This is a very, very intense scene. Like, I don't know if any picture or movie could really give justice what's going on, but this had to be an awesome and terrifying sight, really. Looking back at verse 16, there were thunders and lightnings. I don't know about you, but I was woken up by that big thunderstorm the other night. Was that like Tuesday of this week, or maybe it was even last week? I don't remember. But it was very loud. When I was driving with Stephanie back from South Carolina this summer, We had just crossed into Indiana territory from coming up from Louisville, and there it decided, okay, it's going to rain and pour as just about as hard as I've ever had to drive through. And the lightning was really picking up, and it kept getting a little closer and closer. And then at one point, as I was driving in the field to my right, probably maybe 100 yards, a football field away, a big bolt hit the ground. I was like, whoa, okay, where's the next gas station? I need to gas up anyway, because I legitimately was getting low. So a little bit more, because I was having a hard time seeing anyway, even with the white windshield wipers going full. A little bit later, got gas, and by the time we had done that, the storm had blown over. But that alone was, you know, kind of terrifying, especially as you're trying to drive through it. Add to that that there's this thick cloud on the mountain. It's smoke, and there's even fire. And not only that, there's this trumpet that gets louder and louder and louder and louder. This is quite a terrifying, awesome experience. And so as we see going into chapter 20, God has come down on the mountain in what amounts to a theophany. God speaks the Ten Commandments so that all can hear. And you may say, well, wait, all can hear? We'll just hold that question for a minute. But three key points about what is occurring now at Mount Sinai that all have to do with the fact that God is further revealing himself in a new way to Israel. His holiness is highlighted by the fact that they had to consecrate themselves. This even, to a certain extent, reminds us of when Moses first encountered the burning bush. He was told to remove his shoes because he was on holy ground. So the people had to consecrate themselves, highlighting God's holiness. His presence is now seen, felt, and heard by all the people because God has arrived. And then God further reveals himself by speaking directly to all the people. And this, we won't read all the Ten Commandments, but this leads us all the way up to verses 18 through 21 in chapter 20. At this point, the people are terrified. Okay? They plead with Moses to speak on their behalf. Verse 18, when all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, and when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. They realized their own sinfulness, their own unworthiness, and even just the physical phenomenon that are going on. They are scared to death. With Moses, and Moses says, fear not, for God has come to prove you, test you, that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not. So Moses is essentially saying, look, this fear that you have should drive you to not sin. Okay, so you don't need to be afraid, but there's a certain amount of fear that is okay to have, having a holy fear before God. So the people are terrified, plead with Moses to go speak to God on their behalf. And then from the rest of chapter 20 and all the way to the end of chapter 23, God gives them the book of the covenant. And it's labeled that in chapter 24, verse 7. And again, we won't have time today to go into the details of that. Maybe if we have time next time, we can briefly touch on that. But after this, after they get the covenant, Moses comes back down off the mount. We're in chapter 24 now. And verse 3, Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and the judgments. And the people answered him with one voice, all and said, all the words which the Lord hath said, we will do. So now this is the second time they've been approached and given this opportunity for a covenant. And they are invited to respond. And they give verbal affirmation. One was to the initial covenant that God offered with no specifics. Now they have all the specifics. They have the Ten Commandments. That's the first part of the covenant. And then they have the second part, the Book of the Covenant. Well, then after that, on the next day, verse 4, Moses gets up early and he writes down all of God's laws. And he makes sacrifices in consecration of the covenant with Israel. And then in verse 7, this is where we see, and he took the book of the covenant. He's just written it. He told them about it yesterday, but now he's written it out. And he reads in the audience of the people. And so this is the third time they're given an opportunity to respond. Second time that they've heard all the specifics. And they say, all that the Lord has said, we will do and obey and be obedient. So they're agreeing to this covenant. Of their own free will, they are agreeing to this covenant. And so the covenant ceremony that they have, under oath, agreed to, this covenant ceremony is then sealed by Moses by sprinkling half the sacrificed blood on them, the sacrifice that he just did in verse 6. Verse 8, Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words." Then Moses and the elders enjoy a ceremonial meal in which they see God. Look at verse 9. Then Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders then went up. They're going up on the mountain. And they saw God of Israel, the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of a sapphire stone, and as it were, the body of heaven in his clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel he laid not his hand. Also they saw God and did eat and drink. I don't know exactly what that all entailed and what that exactly looked like beyond what we have described here. It sounds a little bit like some of the things that John sees in the book of Revelation. But what an experience this was for the elders of Israel, along with Moses, Aaron, and his two sons, that they were able to, as part of the covenant ceremony, part of the covenant relationship, that God has been revealing himself, coming down on the mountain. Now he allows these elders to see him. Some part, something about God that they are seeing. And this brings us really to the end of this, the covenant. It has been given, it has been initiated by God. Three times the people have, it has been brought before them, and three times they have affirmed that all the Lord said, we will do. So now, this relationship that God desires to have with mankind, with Israel, has been formalized. And next time, we will look at the next two points, considering how God desires to dwell with his people and create a holy people, a holy nation. But in closing, I just want to leave you with this thought. I want you to consider how much God desires to have a relationship with you. God went to all this trouble, revealing himself to a people that was not worthy of him. Even between the Red Sea and Mount Sinai, they had grumbled and complained, even though they had already seen God do all these wonders. Israel didn't deserve that covenant of relationship that God wanted to have with them. And neither do we. God, through the new covenant, through the blood of Jesus Christ, has made a way for you to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. Do you have that relationship with him? I trust you do. If you don't know Jesus as your Savior, if that's something that you have never really thought about, maybe you've known for a long time but never actually made a personal decision to ask Jesus to be your Savior, I want to encourage you to not leave today until you talked to one of us, myself, Pastor Sluis, Pastor Joel, Brother Daryl here, if you know one of our deacons, or one of our deacons' wives. There is nothing more important than having that relationship with God. Because that's where we started. That was the purpose for our creation, so that we would enjoy that obedient relationship with God. But we messed it up. And then, years later, God sought to have some semblance of that relationship back through Israel. And they failed. And then the old covenant, which was never meant to in the first place, the blood of the bulls and goats could never take away sin. It was all a picture pointing to what Christ would do in the new covenant. That's what we're under now. All we have to do to have that relationship with Jesus Christ, with God, is to confess our sins and throw ourselves at the mercy of God.